So again, I also warmly welcome you, very happy to see you here. Just to ensure that we're all on the same page, to give you a sense of what this weekend is all about, because it's a slightly different format than some of you might be used to if you come here for weekends. So I would hope that we have this retreat basically in silence, and I really echo Deb's encouragement to have a little bit of OCD around turning off your phone. You know, it takes some reorientation, I think, to really do a retreat in an urban environment. You know, I think many of you, you know, you think of retreats and you think about going away from home and you're in a different surroundings, you know, and it's kind of easy to sort of more take up all the guidelines around silence and putting things down. But doing a retreat in the city, in this environment, so close to your life, I think this is a kind of format where we can begin actually to learn some of the lessons that actually really make a difference in our life, about how to cultivate and how to create places of stillness, moments of stillness, moments of unbinding, from our habits of doing, our habits of busyness, our habits of planning, our habits of leaning forward. This is a real opportunity to experiment with what it is in the midst of, you know, this environment, all the sounds around us, the sights around us, to actually know how to pause, how to come and develop some inner quietude, some real sense of present moment attending. And obviously for most people that involves, strangely enough, this word renunciation. You know, what am I actually going to put down in order to be here most wholeheartedly? You know, and mostly when we look at what we're going to put down to be anywhere most wholeheartedly, it's some of our habits, some of our addictions around doing, around busyness, around being available, you know, and how to just put down some of that orientation and actually really cultivate a climate here inwardly that is really has the optimal conditions for learning, for listening, for deepening, and always remembering that those optimal conditions are always in our hands. You know, you could be in the most secluded retreat city setting on top of a mountain, and unless you really have the commitment and the intention to cultivate those optimal conditions inwardly for learning, really you could be anywhere. Okay? You could be anywhere. So some of that unbinding, really knowing the world actually can probably survive without us for a day or two, at least for these few hours. And what does it mean to actually really settle and to still and to calm and to be here? Now, what we're going to do over this weekend, the format of it, it's put forward as a study retreat. I'm in the process, endless process, of trying to find a better word than the word study. You know, because I think most people, when they hear the word study, they hearken back to academic days, you know, of cramming themselves with information and, you know, having to learn and to memorize and to succeed and to achieve. And that's also exhausting, you know. So I think a contemplative inquiry is probably a better phrase. Now, that contemplative inquiry involves me talking a lot, you know. But I hope this is not just one way, you know, because learning is never a one-way street, is it? It's also about how you engage with what you hear, you know, what does this mean for me? What does this look like in my life? How do I understand this? How do I embody this? So genuine learning is never a one-way street. It's a participatory exploration. But contemplative inquiry, you know, it's interesting in the teaching of the Buddha when he talks about the development of insight as a process. You know, and the Buddha is very clear, insights are not something we have, by the way. Insights are something we practice. They're understandings we practice. And I think often when we hear the word insight, you know, it kind of sets up this weird, very weird expectation of kind of waiting for our own Bodhi tree moment. You know, I just sit and hope I'm going to get my Bodhi tree moment, you know, just like I hear the Buddha did, you know, and then everything's going to be changed through that Bodhi tree moment. Now, insight is really, you know, it's another word for understanding, isn't it? For deep understanding. For deep understanding. And the Buddha really speaks of this process of developing this deep understanding, by the way, which is meant to transform, which is really in the service of bringing distress to an end, which is really in the service of supporting us to be the fluid, creative, responsive, compassionate people we have the capacity to be. So when the Buddha speaks about developing this understanding, he says the first step is actually to listen to the teaching. You know, and if you were to look at some of the early texts, you see that most of the Buddha's teaching medium is actually through conversation. It's actually through conversation, through dialogue, through communication. You know, he roams around and he has these communications, sometimes arguments, actually, with people who hold very, very different views. So he says the first step in this development of understanding is to listen to the teaching. That may seem obvious, but it's actually the first point where we begin perhaps to question some of the views we hold and that we hold as being absolutes. You know, the views that we don't even know that we hold until we hear a different view. I know how important this was in my own early years of practice when, you know, I, like many others, you know, went off to Asia, you know, looking for a guru, looking to find my real self, you know, looking for the fast track to enlightenment, and oddly found myself landing in the Gelup tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, which is the most study-oriented lineage within Tibetan Buddhism. You know, so strangely, I find myself landing with a teacher who actually forbids formal practice for the first year. He says, what is the point of sitting if you don't know why you're doing it? If you don't know what it's in the service of? If you don't have a context for that practice? If you haven't even clarified your own motivations or aspirations? He says, what point do you think there is in just sitting on a cushion? It was a good point. It was a good point. So the first year was really spent listening to the teaching. You know, doing a lot of encouraged reflections, a lot of encouraged contemplations. How do I understand this? How does it challenge views that I hold that I didn't even know I held? You know, and this was actually quite critical. You know, I mean, I grew up in my early years in Northern Ontario. You know, any of you who've ever lived in Northern Ontario know that much of nature is out to get you, one way or another. You know, one way or another, it's out to get you. You know, it was just a norm that you killed everything that was out to get you. You know. It didn't even have to be out to get you. You had to perceive that it was going to be out to get you, you know, and you killed it, you know. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, collective cultural norm, you know, to engage in this sort of mass annihilation of anything that moved, that was slightly annoying, you know. Never occurred to me that this might not be the best idea, you know, until I listened to my teacher saying, actually, you know, I think there's some questions about this, you know. You know, have you looked at the mind that's involved in this? You know, have you looked at the relationship you have with life, with living creatures? You know, that there might be a better way to navigate your way through annoyance other than murder. And so, I didn't even know I held that view. That was just a collective norm, you know, that was just an assumption, you know. Never occurred to me, you know, it always puzzled me how this group of refugees who'd lost everything how they could be so intact, how they could be so radiant, so welcoming, so generous in the face of all that they had faced, you know. And that was a huge teaching, to hear that there may be another way of responding to loss and to violence and to trauma other than with rage. And so listening to the teaching is the first step, perhaps, in beginning to change views, and often views, as I say, that we don't even know that we hold, but they're the lens through which we see the world and interpret the world and perceive the world. And, you know, we hold so many views about ourselves, about others, about life, about, you know, around politics, about everything. It's not to say that we're in the endeavor of kind of an erasing views, you know, because there is such a thing as right view. So please, but what we are in the service of is trying to undo the clinging to views as absolutes, you know, and trying to engage in a more contemplative, a more inquiring way of being in this world where we can actually learn. But we can learn. So listening to the teaching is always the first step in that. Sounds like I'm trying to sell this weekend, isn't it? You spent 2 days listening to the teaching, and there's a good history to this. And then to examine this intellectually, you know, does this make sense to me? You know, does it actually pan out? You know, I try it out in different situations. You know, does this actually make sense? Do I have some agreement with this? Explore it experientially. Ah, what are the implications of this, you know, in this body, mind, heart, life relationship? What are the implications of this teaching? And then the last step, of course, which I think is perhaps probably the most challenging, is to embody those understandings. Not to hold them as fine theories, but remembering that insights are something we practice. If they're going to have any effect in our life at all, understandings are something that we practice. And isn't this true? This is often an area where we find, you know, a disturbing dissonance between what we understand and how we live and how we speak and how we relate. You know, we all know about impermanence. Do we live in, what would it mean to live in the light of that understanding? It's quite profound implications. Terms of our relationships, you know, we all know that aversion leads to distress and alienation. What does it mean to live in the light of that understanding? You know, we all know that the world we live in, needs our conscious, compassionate, awakeful participation. If there's going to be a difference, what does it mean to live in the light of that understanding? So insight, understanding, I think, always has implications, you know, and the dissonance that we find between what we know and what we live, as disturbing as it can be, I feel it's very important not to make that a negative disturbance. But that's actually the classroom of this path, because the Buddha certainly didn't just teach formal meditation. In fact, that was, you know, some of his teaching, what he really taught was, you know, the value of living an awakened life, you know, and that life includes everything. There's nothing exempt, there's nothing left out, you know? So living an awakened life. So this weekend I have a theme. I hope I've got the right one. So I would really like to explore the Buddhist teachings on what are called the Brahmaviharas as pathways of awakening. Am I in the right place? Good. As pathways of awakening, not as a sort of side dish on the menu, but as genuine pathways of liberation as the Buddha presented them in the early teachings. So there's quite a lot I would like to offer on this, and I hope that you will engage with your own kind of contemplation and understanding of that. So the setup for the weekend. Yes, I have quite a bit of material I'd like to cover. I'd like to make pause moments for questions, reflections. I'd like to get some periods of quietude in here, some sitting and some walking, and because I think that kind of inner stillness that we can nurture and nourish inwardly is just so supportive of being able to listen and to absorb and to question. So I don't actually have a schedule. I think we'll play this a little bit by ear. We'll be aiming for, do we end at 4:30? Yeah? So we'll be aiming for a 12:30 lunch break around then. But what I'd like to suggest is that we begin the day with a sitting and a walking period, just as a way of actually arriving and settling and, being here in a way that's supportive to us all. If you want to take a moment to stand up and stretch before we do that, that's fine. And just to let you know that the weekend will be recorded and then available on the SIMS website, okay? So you don't have to feel anxieties about having to remember every single thing that's said, okay? Okay, so let's start by finding a posture where there's a sense of embodied intentionality, where the intention of wakefulness and alertness is embodied within the posture. Feeling the uprightness of your spine as much as you can. Sense of your head being balanced, your neck upright, and just a felt sense of what it is to sit. Your feet touching the ground. Your hands touching your legs. Really sitting in the midst of the sounds, in the midst of the sensations, in the midst of the thoughts. It is to establish a ground of wakefulness, a ground of mindfulness, in the midst of all of this, the felt sense of the body, and the felt sense of the body breathing, creating a quality of inner collectedness, a unifying and integrating of body, mind, so being sensitive to the moments when your attention is drawn away from your body, a thought as a thought, and then being able to reestablish the intention, being wholeheartedly present within the body breathing. When you read some of the early texts and the Buddha's talking about the process of meditative development, one of the images or one of the metaphors that's really used again and again is around cow herding. There's a lot of cows in the early teachings. So you have to remember this was a very, agrarian society. So when the Buddha uses these very agrarian images, it was something people can really relate to. I realize there's not a whole lot of cows in Seattle, but, you can probably get the sense of what is meant by cow herding. And the Buddha talks about sort of gathering the cows in from these pastures that no longer nourish them, no longer serve them well, and moving the cows to pastures that are nourishing. And of course, the cows, the wandering cows, our sort of, you know, fragmented thinking, you know, our excess narratives, our stories and our commentary and our distractedness. So I think it's quite a useful image. I find it quite a lovely one, you know. Herding the cows, gathering the cows, you know, and actually, you know, moving them from pastures, that moving our attention from pastures is not necessarily nourishing, into the kind of present moment recollection that is nourishing. It's a process that goes on quite a few times, isn't it? It's gathering the cows. It's a lot kinder way than saying, you know, be attentive, you know. Gathering the cows in. So I'd suggest that we take a walking period now for half an hour, and we'd be coming back at 10:15. And I'd really suggest that you actually really use this first couple of periods of formal practice as a way of really arriving and stilling. And walking practice, as many of you know, involves actually, it's really helpful to have a walking path rather than a walking wander. It's really helpful to put that container around it so that that container really reflects really how we are within that walking path. So it becomes an intentional exploration rather than just wandering around. So finding a walking path for yourself, there's quite a bit of room inside, upstairs, parking lot. You don't need a lot of space to do walking practice. You know, you only need, you know, 5 yards, plenty, you know, less. Just enough to really be able to stand, to inhabit your body, to actually feel your body in the context of the environment that it's in, you know, with the air, the sounds, you know, the sights that are surrounding you. You know, so often, and we'll speak about this later on the weekend, you know, equanimity is really to be in the midst of. It's to be in the midst of. That's already where we are, by the way. But it's being in the midst of, with this sense of collectedness and poise and balance. You know, you can walk in the parking lot outside, but really sensing again this sort of this unification, this integration of body, mind, and present moment. This is really the definition of samadhi, or collectedness. It's this unification of body, mind, and present moment. That's not always the place where we're resting, is it? Often it's body one place, mind another, present moment hardly even on the radar. This unification of body, mind, present moment. Cultivating that quality as we walk, rooting our attention within the body. Pace doesn't have to be super slow. Pace should really be responsive to whatever your mood is just now. If you find yourself quite dull, walk a little bit quicker. You know, if you find yourself quite agitated, walk a little bit slower. Really knowing, you know, that pace responsive to the present moment is a way actually really beginning to include mind states and moods, the awareness of that within the walking practice. Okay, so we'll come back at, 10:20, so if you could ring the bell at 10:15, and we'll come back to begin this exploration.